Good morning and welcome to The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. It's a weekly program about health, fitness, nutrition, and lifestyle in general. I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm Tim Henney. Today in the program, we look at food through the lens of art and culture. First, Food is Art with Adam Ross, the owner and chef of Twisted Fern.
And then we look at art and activism as it relates to food. The documentary film Wasted dealt with the topic of food waste. It was screened at the Park City Film Series several months ago. And from that sharing of art, a group of concerned citizens formed to tackle this issue of food waste here in Park City. Josh Hobson, who spearheads the group, joins us to talk about that.
This is all part of our monthly art and culture segment curated by the Park City Summit County Arts Council.
And finally, at 9:40, we speak with a Park City legend. Born and raised here, Rosie Brennan will be representing the U.S. and Park City in the 2018 Winter Olympics as a cross-country skier. She joins us from Austria via Skype, where she will be putting on the final touches of her training. This is The Mountain Life. Stay with us. We'll be back after these words.
For adventurers on a budget, the Utah Olympic Park offers a host of activities at no charge. Admission and parking are always free. Start with a tour of the Alf Engen Ski Museum and the Eccles 2002 Winter Games Museum. Best of all, come support athletes from all over the world who train at the park. Open daily from 9 a.m. to 6 p.m. Details available at utaholympiclegacy.org.
Utah Olympic Park is a nonprofit organization dedicated to providing winter sport and recreation opportunities and a KPCW supporter.
This is J.C. Coleman, manager of the Park City branch of Fairway Independent Mortgage, helping out KPCW. Celebrating 20 years, the Fairway Independent Mortgage team provides lending options for jumbo, conventional, condo, hotel financing, and more for the Park City homebuyer, located at 1245 Deer Valley Drive. Details at lendtopc.com, NMLS number 2289.
This is Dr. Phil Davidson from Davidson Orthopedics, proud sponsor of KPCW. We're pleased to announce the opening of our new Park City office in New Park at 1122 Center Drive, right behind Jupiter Bowl. More information on our website at davidsonorthopedics.com.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Welcome back to The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware Peak, here with Tim Henney. Well, each month for the last year or so, Hadley Dynack of the Park City Summit County Arts Council has curated a segment on The Mountain Life about the connection of art and culture to our mountain lifestyle. This month, along with Hadley, we look at something near and dear to us, food, and the connection that food has to art and to our mountain lifestyle. We have two segments. The first, food and art, as seen through the lens of a chef and someone who has recently opened a restaurant here in Park City. It's Adam Ross from Twisted Fern. We're also joined by Josh Hobson, who recently spearheaded a group that is tackling the issue of food waste in our town, which was also inspired by art. It was the documentary film Wasted, which was executive produced and narrated by Anthony Bourdain, who we all know and love. But welcome, Hadley Dynack, Josh Hobson, and Adam Ross. Nice to have you all here.
Good morning.
Morning.
Well, let's just start with this. Hadley, why don't you kick it off with telling us how you see the connection of food and art and why you thought about bringing this as this month's theme.
Sure. Thanks, Lynn and Tim. And good morning again. You know, I was actually invited to speak at the Park City Institute's 20th anniversary celebration last weekend. And as I was preparing my remarks for the topic of why art matters, I immediately fell into the metaphor of food. I think, you know, talked a lot about how food and the ingredients that go into baking things like a celebratory cake for an anniversary party. You know, there's the decorations on top, which we often think about when we think about art, the sprinkles and the icing and the candles. But then there's the binding ingredients, right? The flour and the eggs and the sugar that bring it all together and hold it and are the foundation. And so I talked a little bit about that in my remarks, and I think that that is kind of an introduction for why food is important, right? Food is where we come together as a community. We sit down at a table, and it's also the kind of core pieces of why and what we are when we think about arts and culture.
Yeah, so Adam, I'm sure this is kind of part of what you go through when you're, you know, coming up with the concept for a new restaurant. And you were a chef in town for a long time, not at your own restaurant. And what was that final sort of tipping point that made you say, hey, this is what I want to do, and I want to do it artfully and in my own way?
I think there's a pretty big niche in town missing. Mm-hmm. For really vegetable-driven cuisine, mm-hmm. not necessarily a vegetarian restaurant, but just a vegetable-driven restaurant. And I spent some time looking around with my wife for spaces. It took about a year or so. And one finally popped up that was off the market, and then it went back on. And we kind of just threw our name in the hat, and if you would, and they took us.
Yeah.
So from there, I was like, okay, we're doing this. And that was about a year ago now. And June 2nd, we opened. We turned it around in about 3 months.
That's impressive.
Adam, are you an artist or are you a chef? Or is there enough common ground that you can't separate one from the other?
I think it's common ground.
And do you think that's specific to you, or do you think that's specific to the industry? I mean, obviously, we have restaurants that are in business to be a restaurant, mm-hmm. and everybody's more of a producer rather than a creator, mm-hmm. or they're not expressing themselves creatively. And I would think there's also the other end of the spectrum, which is where it's all about the creative expression and it doesn't turn out to be much of a business.
Yes, there's a fine line that you have to play. Not everybody's going to love your favorite creation, and you have to know when to kind of reel it back in and produce something that's 9 out of 10 people are going to enjoy. So that's it's a fun struggle to do that.
And Josh, you've been doing that for a while too. Yeah. I mean, you're a chef in town, and you've worked at a number of establishments and restaurants over the years. And what's your take on the creative aspect of?
I really consider myself more of an artisan than an artist. I use my head, my hands, and my heart when I create, like an artist does. But I also understand that I'm making a consumable commodity that will be gone in less time than it took to prepare. And when you're creating, you know, whether it's a painting or a dance piece, you know, I think that's slightly different. You know, the audience interaction is a little bit different. But really, there are aspects of the artistry that I love, that I'm drawn to, that keep me in this industry. As well as some of the more, you know, scientific backing of the actual, like, the baking process, the nexus that's created between the butter and the flour and the sugar that, you know, holds all that together. You know, like, it's great to kind of understand both ends of it, but I understand in my culinary career, I might have artistic visions. I might have this idea of this great plate of food that would absolutely appeal to me, that would not sell on the menu even as a special, so, or might appeal to a very, very small group of people. And because I've never worked at a restaurant whose budget was limitless, I can't, you know, I have to reel that in.
Interesting. I've never pondered before the difference between art, being an artist, and an artisan.
Yeah, I like that distinction.
Right, right. And I also just figured out why I don't like to cook that much, because it takes a long time and then you just eat it and it's gone. And that's why Adam and people like you are here doing what you're doing. By the way, the chicken fried portobello mushroom is my favorite dish. And so maybe you could just go through a couple of your dishes and talk about at Twisted Fern and talk about, you know, why they were created, or what, you know, if there's something that you feel more tied to as an artisan or an artist.
Yeah. So the chicken fried portobello was kind of my take on one of the popular items of today is the chicken and waffles, or just the mm-hmm. fried chicken in general is very in vogue for the past few years. And I was like, well, how can I do this with like a vegetarian flair that's going to appeal to the meat eater? So I did a few different veggies, and I ended up compressing a portobello with just a vacuum sealer, and then marinating it, dredging it, and frying it, and it came out awesome. It came out with a nice meaty texture. And then the peppercorn gravy is just kind of iconic gravy. And the cauliflower grits was just a nice touch as well. Kind of throw a little southern flair to it even more with a kind of updated way of eating, I guess.
Yeah, so that strikes me as very artistic, you know, just blending together flavors and styles from different parts of the country and putting in a completely new ingredient that would have someone like, I don't think I've ever ordered fried chicken, mm-hmm. but I will order all the time chicken fried portobello mushroom. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that's the bringing the art to someone's palate.
That's one that appeals to me. So that's going to be the next item I order at Twisted Fern. So what about just the food movement in Park City? I'm thinking about how over the 26 years that I've been here, there have been restaurants that have come and gone. There have been restaurants that have stayed. I mean, I think of River Horse and Grappa. They're kind of been here forever. And it seems like through the different iterations and the evolution over time, there is something that's happening here. We've become known as a cuisine mecca to some degree. People come here and we advertise ourselves, we promote ourselves as being a place with great food. And maybe Deer Valley had something to do with that with their chili and, you know, the whole push and the emphasis on service and food from the beginning. But it seems to me that the town is being more recognized, and is there a connection to the evolution of the artistic side versus just the business side, just creating an establishment to run a business and make money versus actually trying to provide a different sort of experience through art? And either one of you can jump in on that.
So my working actually for Deer Valley up the Mariposa the first three winters I was here, for Clark Norris, who at that time I still put him in the top chefs in this state, because just the breadth of knowledge that he has, his techniques, his ability, all that. But my understanding from talking with him is really it was the 2002 Olympics was one of those turning points that brought a lot more interest in being, you know, more of an experience when you're in Park City. And, you know, that includes the slopes, that includes all the arts and entertainment that we have. But, you know, people realized, hey, I can make this a little bit fancier than they sell down in Tooele and maybe make a little bit more money on it, but also appeal to the kind of tourists that Park City brings in. And, you know, kind of brought along the locals for the ride, because I think largely we eat better in Park City than some of our neighboring communities do. And I kind of attribute that to both who's here and, you know, the fact that, yeah, as a community, we take arts as something important. We also are willing to spend a little bit more money on experience. And so that leaves the, you know, kind of the space open for a restaurant like a River Horse or like a Grappa, where you're going to spend a little bit more, but you're going to get such a fine experience out of it. I mean, I worked at the Mariposa for 3 years. I can tell you everything I ate each time that I've eaten there over the span of the 7 years that I've lived here now, because every time it's, you know, just, it's one of those wow experiences. And I think as a community, we respond well to that.
I'll just jump in and say, in addition to this kind of incredible, I think, renaissance of our culinary community and, you know, the types of facilities and spaces that are popping up, both large and small and both expensive and less expensive, we have a growing artisan creative food producer movement here. That's happening in lots of places around the country, but I think it's really exciting that it's happening here. You know, we have chocolate makers, we have lots of coffee makers, we have granola makers. So I think there are these makers, these creative entrepreneurs that are also part of our culinary community, if you will, that you know, are helping shape our palates.
And how about artisan pancakes? Kodiak cakes. I saw someone hauling a big load of Kodiak cakes into the city building yesterday, and I thought, wow, there's another local business that has really played and succeeded based on its artisan qualities, and I'm not sure what makes it that, but I'm sure their business founder could tell us.
What you both just said, it occurs to me that, you know, we're pairing food with other activities here. And I'm wondering when the point comes where you no longer pair the food with other activities and experiences to create a whole experience, but the food stands on its own. And I'm thinking in terms of when you plan a trip to Italy, what are the things you're planning on doing in Italy? By and large, I think for 90% of the people who go, you're going to drink good wine, you're going to eat good food, and you're going to see interesting sights that you don't normally see. There's not
in
really...
that order.
Yeah, kind of in that order. And so it stands a little more on its own. And I'm sure like music stands on its own in Memphis, Tennessee, and in Nashville,
Austin,
and in Austin. And now food is beginning to stand on its own here. It feels to me, it appears to me. Is it? Am I on track with that?
I think we're going in that direction. I think for the long run. So when I got here about 12 years ago, a lot of the food scene was really based off of just pushing people through the door. More of that, it's a business sense. Mm-hmm. Food is kind of second.
Turning tables,
burn and turn, no matter what price point you're looking at. Mm-hmm. Very much tourist driven. And I think with the economy, the demographic always growing in this town, mm-hmm. there's more substance. Like mud season is about 2 weeks now instead of 2 months on the shoulder seasons, so we can have these restaurants that produce amazing product on Main Street, off Main Street, at all three resorts, and they can sustain because of the growing population. People will spend money on food now, where it was used to be just a commodity, like, mm-hmm. I need food in my face now. Now they want to go out, they'll wait 30 minutes for a table, 45 an hour for a table, mm-hmm. because they know the experience is going to be worth it.
And have we finally surmounted, I always remember this, when I worked in restaurants on Main Street back in the 90s, people from either coast that came to visit here would be very cautious or would never order sushi or, you know, fresh fish because they
seafood
think, you know,
Utah.
we're in Utah. That you know, have we finally surmounted that kind of belief system? Like, we know that we can fly fish here overnight.
I think we're close to it. We're not over the hill, but I think we're getting close. I mean,
Given the number of viable sushi joints in this town, I think they're okay. Yeah.
And some of the best sushi I've had. Yeah. So Twisted Fern, since we're one day away from the start of Sundance, of course, listeners want to know if you're actually going to be open during Sundance or what?
Yes, we'll be open for lunch and dinner. I do have a few privates. Mm-hmm. So tomorrow I'll be closed from 2 to 5. And then Monday from 9 p.m., actually, say 7 p.m. to, end of dinner service would be 7 p.m., would be last seating. Those are the only two privates that I have in-house, and I'll be open for the general public.
Excellent, which is a great local option because you're located in the Snow Creek Center in the same place that the Park City Market is and the liquor store. And down at the end, if you're facing the market, down on the right-hand side. And help me expand my repertoire. What's the next thing I'm going to order? And aside from the chicken fried portobello?
So right now I have a Spanish octopus that's really popular.
I had that. It was terrific.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Glad to hear that. It's super tender. It's pairing with a saffron polenta and a house-made all-natural Nyman Ranch pork bacon that's cured with Hugo coffee. Mm. So it's got a nice little coffee kick to it.
Maybe I liked it because of the bacon.
I
love octopus. I love seafood in general. But I do remember that being a particularly good octopus dish.
Thank you.
And I might like it because of the Hugo coffee. Yeah.
And the bacon.
Yeah. Okay. Well, great. As a means to sort of segue into our next conversation about food waste, it strikes me that the way we used to do food here in Park City could be thought of as, you know, what has the longest shelf life, because we're not really sure when our crowds are going to come. And certainly during mud season that lasts months and months and months, we really ought to just keep a lot of potatoes on hand because they have a great shelf life. So now that we're cooking with all of these, I would imagine, highly perishable foods, this must be a complicated topic for any chef in town. But we know that through the training you've gotten, you have been trained to not waste anything. So,
yeah, stocks and sauces and let me back up a step before I address what I do and kind of say what we saw the problem as. And really the showing of the movie Wasted really was the impetus for this. Afterwards, there was a panel discussion, and Jody Rogers from Deer Valley was one of the panelists. And when I worked at Deer Valley, I worked with Jody for years, and we really, after the show, kind of came together and be like, how can we deal with this? How can we move forward on this? And took a couple of days, and we kind of reconnected and just like, all right, these are the thoughts I've had. She had kind of communicated back with the James Beard Foundation, of which she's a member, and seen kind of what they're doing and a lot of the possibilities that are out there. But basically, we see it as there are two parallel issues. There is edible waste that can get to hungry people, and it does not need to travel very far to be effective. It certainly doesn't have to go down Parley's Canyon. And then there is the post-consumer waste. There either the stuff from the kitchen, like the stalks, all the things left over in the food making process, and then there's what's left on the plate. And a lot of that, the next best use, and this is one of the points that the film made, the next best use after feeding people is feeding animals, and potentially turning that wasted food back into new food. Beyond that, then it's composting, and then, you know, really the team that we've assembled, one of the things we are looking at is down the road potentially an aerobic digester to kind of take the balance of what's left, because there's plenty that you cannot feed to a pig or a chicken still. But at the same time, it's a great opportunity because, again, with the volume of people in town right now, you know, the edible waste, hopefully it's our jobs as chefs to keep that as a minimum. That's our food cost. That, you know, and as a business, we try to keep that down. There are discussions along the side of controlling portions to, you know, try to minimize what's left on the plate as well. But there will always be something left over. And so then what do we do with that? Because just sending it to the landfill isn't working, and it's not sufficient. We can do better.
Some really horrifying statistics on food waste, and this came from the documentary again. It's called Wasted, the Story of Food Waste. It's executive produced and narrated by Anthony Bourdain. But a third of all food produced is never eaten. Over 90% of wasted food in the U.S. ends up in landfills. And the annual cost of food waste is $1 trillion. And what we know about food ending up in landfills, it turns into methane. And from my understanding, methane is twice the environmental impact that CO2 has. Right. We talk a lot about CO2, but methane is much more toxic.
And that's actually why we're looking potentially at an aerobic digester to turn that methane into usable energy. Because, it, you know, again, it's not ideal, but we will always have that remainder left over, and better to do something beneficial with it than to just send it to the landfill. And worst especially is that food waste trapped inside of polystyrene containers.
Right. Sorry to interrupt this conversation. We did just get a call from our general manager, Renee Bodley, saying that there's an accident on 224 around Sun Peak. It's really backing up the traffic on the way into town. If you are on your way into town, you might consider that. Perhaps go around via Highway 40 and come in through 248. Yeah, so continuing on.
Josh, you've touched on this already, and Adam, feel free to weigh in. But what is the opportunity? I mean, we can look at this as a problem or an opportunity in Park City. And can you describe the dimensions of the challenge or the opportunity that we have in the town currently?
Well, the first thing that we as a group decided is we actually need to really assess what the problem is here. So what we did, and thank you, Lynn, and your help with this, is sent a survey to most of the restaurants in town to kind of gauge the level of waste being created and see what's currently being done. Bill White's Farms are doing quite a bit. The restaurant that I'm currently at doesn't really do much. And, you know, so seeing kind of what is currently being done, what can easily, without much infrastructure, without much logistics, can be replicated, and then look into more thoroughly, all right, how do we do it? Kind of the model that we're looking at is essentially app-based, where the restaurant says, okay, I've got some food pickup, which will then be diverted to the Christian Center, and then a waste pickup, and potentially getting specific containers for, you know, kind of sorting all of that and making sure it goes to the right spots. And again, those will be reusable containers. You know, but really right now we do need more information. So we've already gotten back a good number of surveys, but, you know, and we did try the timing of it to get it out before Sundance, before everyone gets overwhelmed by the next week and a half. But there really are some possibilities. The best, I was in contact with both Chris Robinson and Tom Fisher to look for farms in the county that some of this waste could be sent to. And at the moment, there is not a pig farm, there's not a hog ranch in Summit County. And the best idea that I've come up with when I was out on a bike ride one afternoon would be to essentially create a school farm somewhere in the county with enough pigs and chickens to accommodate the bulk of our waste, and then educational opportunities for the kids. Any school in the county can show up and learn more about the life cycle of their food, of, you know, and actually how to, you know, how things grow, you know, and definitely have a you know, vegetable garden there too. I have no expertise in running a farm, but I think it's the most elegant solution so far that I've come up with. But again, we have a group of good, pretty smart people working on it. So I think, you know, give us a month or two to really assess where we are, and I think we're going to have some pretty good ideas.
So using the Bill White model, you know, before Bill had the farm and the ranch, he didn't have that other end of the stream where all the food and the waste goes. And you're looking for others. Now, the Silly Market has pigs at their disposal during the summer, and I don't know what those pigs are doing in the winter or who's feeding them or how the food gets to them, but there is that end that they've tapped into already. And I see, you know, again, over the course of time, this is starting to come together. But do you think from the front end, the survey that you're getting accurate information? Because wouldn't you think that at a restaurant, they'd want to be like, yeah, of course we do all we can do.
Right.
And so they're going to kind of grade themselves a little better than might actually be happening.
I think it will give us at least a baseline to work from. Yeah. And then once we get to the implementation stage, we'll actually see, you know, how that plays out, you know, how truthful those surveys were, or, you know, I mean, how good at estimating you are. Like, on a nightly basis, I don't know, do I make 30 pounds of food waste? Do I make 40? Mm-hmm. I'm not sure.
I think one of the big challenges for especially restaurants in Main Street, and Adam, maybe you could jump in on this because you're not on Main Street, is the issue of space and having 4 or 5 different bins to first separate all the recyclables and then the food that goes to the hogs or the food that goes to the anaerobic digester or whatever it is. That's a real challenge. Maybe you could talk about what you do.
Yeah. Space is definitely a challenge, but if there's a will, there's a way. If you really are dedicated to doing something, you can figure out a way to do it. Mm-hmm. I was on Main Street for 10 years, and I recycled for 9 of those years, I believe. Glass, cardboard, aluminum, pretty much the entire gamut. I did not compost then. I am doing all of that plus composting now. I do need to look into, after cooking, after eating food waste, so where the pigs come in.
Right.
Because you can't compost cooked food or anything a human touched, basically.
Right. That whole thing is interesting. In this film, Wasted, they sent food off, specific types of food to specific hog farms, and this was in Japan. And so, for example, they would send off the green leafy vegetables I don't know, I'm just throwing that out there, to this one hog farm, and it would end up creating a certain taste within the pork. And the other hog farm got all the fish scraps. And I thought that was very interesting, something we're not even clued into yet, really, in this town.
Well, and really, I see one of the biggest challenges in front of us is we can create the perfect logistic scenario of how to get it from the restaurant to wherever it's going and figure out the funding structure for it and create all of that. But it's the educational component in the restaurant, in the kitchens, the servers, all the prep cooks, educational component, I think, is going to be a hurdle, and we're going to need to present that in both English and Spanish, because that's the reality of the makeup of our kitchens here. But, you know, really, it's going to come down to individual cooks who care versus the ones who are just going to save themselves 3 seconds and just put it all into the trash anyway.
Well, and if you can add, you know, a free market driver to this whole thing with the digester, if you can create energy and you can sell that energy to a municipality, then you have a revenue stream that you're generating, and that gives a little more incentive.
Oh, I like a CSA model for what we do with the pigs and the chickens.
Right. But
Josh Hobson is joining us in the studio, along with Adam Ross, the chef and owner of Twisted Fern, Hadley Dynock, the Park City Summit County Arts Council Executive Director. You want to just wrap up with a final word?
Sure. Well, first of all, thank you guys for joining us and having this conversation about the connection between art and food. And I think to wrap it up, to bring it back to film and how film can be an engagement tool and a way to bring people together to address issues. You know, the community element of this, the conversation that's happening around food waste came out of this film, Wasted, that was produced in a partnership between a local organization, Eats, which is all about bringing healthy food to our children and our families in our community, and the film series, which is all about showcasing stories and the connection between stories and community. And now we've got this group of people that were inspired to come together, catalyzed by the story, to make local action. So I think that's the full circle piece of it.
Thank you. And it is the full circle. And especially on this eve of the Sundance Film Festival, that is what I think we look for, is the film to inspire us to action. And so as we go forward over the next 10 days and wind up in one of those documentaries, we've all had that experience that it's life changing. So I wish that for everyone out there. And thanks to you all, Josh, Adam, and Hadley, for joining us on The Mountain Life. Stay with us. We'll be back in just a moment after this word from our underwriters. We'll be speaking with Rosie Brennan, Park City born and bred. She's going to the Olympics.
Whitney Wall here from Park City Mountain and KPCW's sponsor. Park City Mountain's Epic Promise recently committed to a net zero footprint by 2030. The environment is our business. By 2030, we commit to zero net emissions, zero waste to the landfill, and a zero net operating impact to forests and habitat. More information at epicpromise.com.
Valley Behavioral Health is a local nonprofit and proud supporter of KPCW. We are your community behavioral health center and provide a broad range of services, including individual, family, couples, and group therapy for mental health and substance abuse. We serve all ages in all of Summit County. Please check out our website at valleycares.com or 649-8347 for more information.
Matt here from San Francisco Design. Since the start of our business in 1990, we have been supporting KPCW. We offer home decor for Park City and Salt Lake and feature modern furnishings from around the world. Whether you're looking to furnish an entire home or just redecorating a single room, we can help with our in-house design team. Located on Bonanza Drive and on the web at sanfrandesign.com.
Welcome back to The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware Peak, here with Tim Henney. Well, Park City's own Rosie Brennan will represent the USA and, of course, Park City at the 2018 Winter Olympics, which begin next month in Pyeongchang, South Korea. Brennan, along with her dynamo team of women cross-country skiers, have put the USA on the map for the sport like never before seen in history. To see these girls on the podium gives the viewer an infectious burst of enthusiasm. They're strong, they're winning, and they have fun doing it. Rosie has 5 national titles, 37 U.S. Super Tour podium finishes, 2 World Championship finishes, and a couple handfuls of World Cup finishes, including a podium finish in Norway. She joins us now via Skype from Austria, where she's putting the finishing touches on her training before heading to South Korea. Rosie Brennan, welcome to The Mountain Life.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, we're so excited to have you. And first of all, a big congratulations. I think you got named to the Olympic team about a week ago, maybe?
Yeah, it's probably been about that now.
And so how does one, I mean, I know that each Olympic winter sport is different and every sport is different. And there's this very complex, oftentimes, process for getting named. But how did you get named?
So for cross country, our qualification criteria, the first thing you had to do to get named was to be top 8 in an individual race that was going to be held at the Olympics. So we had, I think, 3 or 4 girls meet that criteria pretty much right off the bat. The second criteria was to be top 50 in kind of like the overall World Cup ranking at a certain date. And so that's how I met that criteria. I was top 50 in the distance standings after the Tour de Ski, which was the last series of races in the qualification period. And now the sprint top 50 sprint list has also just finished this past weekend, and I was also top 50 on that. So that was great news. I had my bases covered in both disciplines. So, yeah, so I made it based on that objective criteria, which it's always nice to make it to qualify that way. You don't have to worry about what the coaches are thinking or anything else. It's just your results that count. And so you kind of are in control of your destiny that way. So that was nice.
Rosie, over the years, for those who pay attention, we've heard your name for a long time around Park City. You've been working towards this dream, and I think, you know, maybe it's not accurate, but I'm going to assume that this is a dream come true for you. And I think the reason I feel like I can say that is because you and the other girls on the U.S. team in the past Olympics and in the current competitions, when you girls are performing, you exude a dream come true attitude, and it comes through so clearly. It is so entrancing and captivating. Is that accurate? And are all of you living your dream come true?
Oh, yeah, for sure. It's, you know, when I was in high school, Wendy Wagner, who's also a cross-country skier from Park City, she was on the national team. And in 2006, right after the Torino Olympics, they actually cut the women's team. And so she no longer was part of the U.S. ski team. There were no women on the U.S. ski team for cross-country. And as a high schooler, that's kind of a tough thing to see. You're looking, you found the sport that you love and you see very little future in it when there's not even a national team. And so it's kind of, you know, it's been a long journey. And I think we have Keegan Randall to thank mostly for that. She, despite not having a national team, decided she was going to do this anyway and did, and took many years and fought very hard and showed all of us younger girls that, you know, how much was possible. And so I think because of that, like, we really don't take anything for granted. And anytime, like, anyone has a success, it's something that the whole team really shares joy in. And I mean, this year we've already had more podiums than we had last year combined. And we still have a champagne toast every time somebody gets on the podium, because it's important to not take those moments for granted and to celebrate everything that we've accomplished in the last, since 2006, 12 years.
And with that history, maybe it's easy to say that you don't take things for granted. Are there other teams that are more of the dynasty teams, the Norwegians, the Russians, who do take things for granted? And is it obvious when you're out there competing and, you know, in a stadium, can you see the different attitude and the different energy between the U.S. team and other teams, maybe teams that do take things a little bit for granted?
Yeah, I think, you know, our team is known for being kind of these smiley, happy, we're all basically blonde American girls, for better or worse.
The Norwegians could be described the same way.
That's true. But we're known to be outgoing. You know, we spend, I left November 15th, from Alaska to come to Europe, and I will be here until the end of March. So, and the whole team is that way. So, you know, we're spending 5 months on the road together. And I think, you know, because of that, we've learned to be outgoing, to talk to other girls on the circuit, make friends. And we kind of have that reputation for being, friendly, outgoing, smiley, happy. And I think people really get a lot of joy out of watching us celebrate even, you know, small victories. Like, you know, sometimes, for me, it's not necessarily the podium that's a victory. You know, maybe it's a top 15, and I think other teams notice how excited we are every time somebody has a success.
That's great. Really, it is palpable whenever I have watched you girls. You know, like you say, even celebrating top 15, you want to jump up and down in your living room with you. It's really fun. So, okay, now I have to ask the question that I was maybe not going to ask, which is, you've been in Austria since November 15th. You'll be there all, or in Europe anyway, all winter. What's the snowpack like over there? I hear it's just been dumping.
Yes, I'm really sorry to say that it has been dumping here for the last 2 days. We are buried in snow. And tomorrow I have to drive to Slovenia for the races this weekend, so I'm actually a little nervous about the road conditions. But, yes, it has been dumping. We've had, it's been, when I first came over to the World Cup, we only skied on man-made loops that were, you know, maybe 3K long. There was no snow. I thought winter was done for. And this is the first year I've been over here where there's been real winter. So it's pretty exciting. It makes you remember why you're in this sport when you can go on a long ski and never ski on the same trail twice. Mm. So that's been really nice. But we did have a rain episode during the Tour de Ski that was really, you know, lightning, thunder. It was an epic event. So I can't say we're immune to these bad situations, but it's been a good winter overall.
Right. I still think maybe Tim and I should sort of forget about it all here and come on over, and we could be part of your cheering section or even perform some other maybe more important task for you.
Like maybe not waxing your skis, but something less important than waxing your skis.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, talk about the wax. And so I was reading something about Jesse Diggins, and I know cross-country skiers always credit their wax technicians with helping them to win whatever they've won, which is so humble and wonderful. But, wow, wax makes a difference in cross-country skiing, you know, 100 times over what it does in alpine skiing. Talk a little bit about that. And like in the Tour de Ski, when you had to deal with the rain.
Yeah. So, waxing is a huge component of our sport. And, you know, for skate and classic, the wax is important. If you're skis aren't fast, and if they aren't also gripping, it's very hard. Often, you know, the difference in a World Cup field between first and 10th, you know, it's maybe 1% of your performance on any given day. So the wax can be that 1%. Like, there's such a small margin for error when you're at the highest level. So it's super important. And we are very lucky because we had a huge fundraising effort over the last couple of years, and we were able to raise enough money to get what we call a wax truck. And so this is essentially a giant semi-truck that expands out. So when it's driving on the road, it looks like any other semi. When it parks in the parking lot at the venue, it expands out both double wide and long, and is a portable wax room. And this is something that the bigger teams, Norway, Sweden, Finland, Russia, they've had these for a number of years, and it's made a huge difference in their ability to wax skis. It takes so much less time to set up, to be ready to go test. It's much safer for the wax techs. You know, we're burning fluorocarbons and all these horrible things, and so they have good ventilation systems, and all of our skis can be stored in there, and the communication is really good because all the techs are in the same space. And so we just unveiled ours this fall, and it's been a huge change, I think, for our whole team. It's just, you know, it kind of brings us all together, and we've had good skis so far, so it seems to be helping us, and it just provides, a good atmosphere. And we, you know, I'm sure a lot of it's also show, but, you know, we have our truck that expands out and it's got pictures of all of us all around it, and it really speaks USA. And so now we're, you know, putting up it's not quite the same size as Norway or Finland yet, but we're at least putting up a stand.
If you're just joining us, we're talking to Rosie Brennan. She's a local Park City kid, grew up here, learned to ski here, and she's been named to the 2018 Olympics for cross-country Nordic skiing in South Korea. And Rosie, about that kind of level of support, you know, with the semi-truck and the wax truck and sort of taking it to the next level. And you said just back in 2006, the team didn't exist. It was cut from USA Skiing. So what is the current state? I mean, you just said you had a fundraiser to get the money for the truck. Where do things stand as far as support with, and I would think that support is growing with the success that you all are showing.
Yes, I mean, I don't know all the details of the numbers, but certainly our success has helped our support grow from U.S. Ski and Snowboard, but also from a more grassroots side. Just, you know, people are really excited about it. The wax truck was a special project that one of our board of trustees kind of put together, and when Keegan Randall took a year off for her pregnancy, she kind of helped. Was the, you know, spearhead for that. And so they went around and saw the other boards of trustees and other donors around the country and raised the money for that. So we have, because of our success, we've been able to kind of get attention for special projects like that. As far as like kind of for our everyday basis, our A team gets support from U.S. Ski and Snowboard, but the B team and lower don't get travel support. So I'm on the B team, so I'm responsible for all my room and board and airfare throughout the season. So, yes, it is improved, but we're always looking for more.
And Rosie, so tell us, you've referenced Keegan Randall a couple of times, and of course, I remember Keegan from back when I was over at Soldier Hollow, and she was sort of the only person that had any attention from the U.S. side at all and was the only person who was occasionally relatively competitive back in those days. But what's her role now, and who has been named to the team?
So Keegan, actually, her first Olympics was in 2002 in part. Oh, are you there?
Yep.
Okay, sorry. So Keegan's first Olympics was 2002. So, yes, some of you may remember her from that. But she's kind of been the stalwart and spearhead for the women's cross-country team. She went on to win three of the Crystal Globe, so overall World Cup sprint titles, 3 years in a row, and then took a year off to have a baby and is now in her second year back. And she still is very much our kind of day-to-day role model, expert, and still gets on the podium. So it hasn't really slowed her down much. And so, yeah, she is also, I am training in Anchorage, Alaska with the Alaska Pacific University Nordic Ski Center, and she's also on that team. So I spend my summers training with her as well, and she's been a huge role model and just overall wonderful person to be on a team with and to represent our sport. So that's been great. And let's see, as for the number of people that have been named, meeting the objective criteria was all seven girls on the A and B teams, as well as the three of the boys on the A and B team, Eric Bjornsson, Andy Newell, and Simi Hamilton.
Nice.
And then the rest will be named between the 22nd and the 25th. They will name the people based on races that were held in the U.S.
And I would assume the names on the A-B women's team are yourself, Keegan Randall, Liz Stevens, Jesse Diggins, and some other names that we would recognize?
Sadie Bjornsson.
Sadie
yep.
Bjornsson.
Sophie Caldwell.
Sadie Bjornsson. Yep. And Ida Sargent.
Oh, yes, yes. Ida Sargent. Excellent. Well, it's so exciting. It's really great to talk to you. And I wanted to point out one thing is that even though we're a mountain town, we're a snow sport town, we do have these mountains and we're not really known for cross-country skiing. And yet here you are making a name for Park City in what some people think of as a flatland sport, you know, what they do in Minnesota. And so, Wendy Wagner, Laura McCabe, you know, these names throughout, over the last decades that come out of Park City. It is kind of unusual, but we're very proud of you.
Yeah, I mean, Park City is an incredible place to train. And, when I first started, pretty much all we had was white pine, which is very flat. but it's been amazing. Like, I mean, every year as I continued to train, the training around Park City grew, both like for summer training and in the bike paths, as well as the ski trails with Round Valley and the Basin Trails. So that's been really exciting for me to see the sport grow in the community, because I mean, it's truly a wonderful way to enjoy winter. It only takes an hour of your time. You don't have to deal with it standing in lift lines or anything, and it's very rewarding and just a great way to enjoy.
And Rosie, as Keegan inspired you and continues to inspire you and the other girls on the team, what would you say to any of the girls in Park City who live in the same town that you grew up and learn to love this sport? Do you have anything to share with them?
Truly believing in yourself. I think that's what Keegan's taught me the most. You know, when you decide you're going to make it on the World Cup when there's not even a national team, you know, that's an incredible amount of belief. And she made it work because she had that kind of belief. So I think just always believing in everything.
Yeah.
You can do it no matter what.
Those are great words. I hope Leah Lang heard that.
Yeah.
Rosie Brennan, well, we'll be cheering you on. Best of luck in South Korea and Pyeongchang. And can you give us the dates that you'll be actually be competing?
I can't.
Okay, so we'll look it up.
Even though we make the team, we don't get specific start spots until, maybe even the night before. So there's cross-country races from the first day all the way to the last day of the game. So we have six events total. So hopefully I'll be out there quite a few times, but I'll keep you posted as it comes.
Okay, that sounds great. Rosie, thank you so much for joining us, and enjoy your last days in Austria before you head over to South Korea.
All right, great. Thank you so much.
Thanks. Bye-bye. And again, Rosie Brennan. Born and bred here in Park City, you too can become an Olympic cross-country skier.
But it starts with a trip. Not me.
Not you, Tim.
It all starts with a trip to Europe where they have a lot of snow.
Oh, I know.
Enough of this traveling to Sun Valley. It's off to Europe.
You know, I hear there's a direct flight to Paris, for example.
Is that close enough?
Yeah. There's probably snow there. Actually, I did see, never mind.
Yeah.
I could go on about this. But let's thank our underwriters, Valley Behavioral Health, Jim Doylney, and Mark Wainsgard with retail at New Park, Utah Olympic Legacy Foundation, Davidson Orthopedics, Fairway Independent Mortgage, Park City Mountain, and Berkshire Hathaway Home Services Utah Properties, also San Francisco Design. Thanks for tuning in this morning. It's KPCW Park City.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided in part by Longrimer Weiniger Bepler, Estate Planning, Family Law, LRW-Law.com. Fred Marshall Painting, painting Park City's home since 1970.